Growing up, I wasn't surrounded by criminal activity. Although I was born and raised in a city, so I'm sure it was around, I was just too young to really be aware of it. My exposure of criminal activity came from movies and shows about crime, and still does to this day. One of my favorite shows is called The Following. It's about an untouchable cult leader slash serial killer that the FBI are continually trying to track down.
You know about the cult?
I like to think of them as my friends. It's important to have friends.
Even though this show is fiction, it's very disturbing because the storyline and acting is so convincing. It captivates me, and I could watch it over and over again. Shows like this and real events that I've heard about on the news have made me wonder something. Why do people have violent urges that they cannot control, and what are the psychological roots of those disturbances?
I grew up in Carbondale and Redstone, Colorado for my whole life. For the 17 years that I have been here, I haven't been affected by the type of crime you hear about in urban settings. However, when I was around the age of 7, my parents were up late watching TV, and they heard gunshots come from our neighbor's house. The renters next door were drunk, and one of them pulled out all of his guns and began shooting out the back windows, into the ceiling, and at the feet of his girlfriend, which put holes in the floor. My parents then called the cops, who said to take my sister and I upstairs, because our room was right next to their living room, which is where the shooting was coming from. Later that night, the police came and arrested him and interviewed his girlfriend. Since this happened at a somewhat young age, I'm not sure if it had sparked my interest in crime. However, I've always been interested in it. I'd watch TV shows like Law & Order, SVU, and CSI, which allowed me to further explore the world of crime.
My name is Giselle Rusnak.
And my name is Belle Raleigh, and we are going to be talking about the psychological influences on serial criminals.
At first, Belle and I wanted to do our podcast on the criminal justice system and the differences between urban and rural crime. However, while we were editing our audio, we decided that we needed to shift our topic to something that would have more of a definitive focus and storyline. This led us to revising our topic and focusing on the psychological influences on serial criminals. After making this change, we had the idea to interview Kim Reel, who is a therapist here in Carbondale, Colorado, and who has a lot of input as she's very familiar with the human mind.
Kim is a tall woman who has a light shade of red hair. She wears glasses around her blue eyes and has freckles covering her face. Kim was dressed in all blue clothing along with a blue hat with a gray palm. Her office had two windows that had teapots and elephant figurines sitting on the sill. There were books on shelves, pictures on the walls, games, and stress balls sitting around the room. We sat across from her on a gray couch with blue and dark gray pillows. As she sat comfortably with her legs crossed on an orange and white striped chair, she told us about herself and answered a few of the questions that we had.
First, we asked her why people continuously commit the crimes they do.
I think that there's probably a lot of reasons, and I'm not sure that we can just hone it into one reason. In my experience working within the legal system, I've noticed that a lot of people, especially people that I've worked with in the past that have been in prison, it's almost like they become systematized from a really young age. Oftentimes their family is involved with the legal system, whether it's social services or the justice system. And from a young age, they're involved and they start getting in trouble, and it kind of just keeps going. And once people go into prison and get this record of a felony, it's really hard for them to find housing. It's hard for them to find and keep jobs. And in fact, I think about one man that I worked with, and we're kind of creating this visualization of a safe place, and it was actually his jail cell, which was really interesting to me that that's where he felt the most comfortable and safe. There's also, I think, with a lot of people that are involved, you know, whether it's crime or serial crime, is a lot of those people do have a history of trauma. A lot of people will reenact, whether it's to maintain a level of chaos in their life that they are most comfortable with, or if it's to gain a sense of power and control. A lot of, serial rapists for sure, people that repetitively like sexually abuse. A lot of those people are really looking for a sense of power, and that is to play out past traumas or to feel like they have a sense of power over things that have happened in their past.
Secondly, we wanted to know what traits serial criminals have.
Some of the traits those people have would be very charismatic or charming, an ability to like read people and manipulate and kind of get in there and really understand how that person ticks and how to get in there to, I don't know, control, manipulate, do what they need to do. Oftentimes they have very little empathy for other people. They oftentimes don't feel things the same way we do, the way we might feel remorse or we might feel sadness. Sometimes these people are really cut off.
Next, we asked how easy it is to identify serial criminals.
You know, I'm thinking about this one man in particular that when I met him, I really liked him. He's this nice guy and he's friendly and he's charming. But there was this part of him that felt slimy, that just made me feel uncomfortable. And truth be told, that is what I had to use first to clue in to what was going on with this person, was the way he made me feel deep down. And then I could start seeing the way he would compliment my outfit that day or comment on what a great mother he suspected I might be. And it was interesting because it wasn't because I talked about myself or gave him information, but because he looked around my office and made observations about who I was as a person, such as the drawing on my desk that my son had made for me or the picture of my son in the corner, and kind of used those things to make some assumptions. And that was one of the ways that he was really trying to get close to me so that he could get what he needed. I think if we're, you know, talking to in the extreme cases of that sociopath or that antisocial, I actually think that it's hard sometimes for professionals to read it too.
Finally, we asked, are people born this way or is it entirely environmental circumstances?
I could see somebody being born with either like genetic or biological predisposition to be impulsive or reactive or anxious or angry, or I could see that, but I definitely believe that people are not just born antisocial or as a sociopath. I do believe that they have to experience some pretty horrendous things for them to develop into that, because it's a pretty far outline behavior in society, and I don't think people are just innately born that way.
After learning about the psychological influences and traits serial criminals have, we wanted to apply it to a real-life situation and to perhaps one of the most gruesome and high-profile serial killers of all time, Jeffrey Dahmer. I'm sure you all know the name Jeffrey Dahmer, but in case you are not familiar with what exactly he did, here's a little background. Jeffrey Dahmer was a serial killer in the late 1970s through the early 1990s, who murdered a total of 17 people, all of whom were males in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin area. Through several of his active years as a killer, my parents lived only 2 hours away. His case is especially fascinating because he didn't kill to kill. He felt his emotional needs were not being fulfilled. We were very fortunate to have the opportunity to speak with Wendy Patricus, who was a second chair on Dahmer's case, which essentially means an assistant lawyer to the lead attorney. Wendy's mother and my grandmother were close friends, and Wendy and my mother attended college together. She is based out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and has been in the field of law for most of her life. She was only 26 years old when she was on the Dahmer case. Our main goal when speaking with her was to hear the observations she made about the kind of man Dahmer was, and to see if he embodied the traits of a sociopath that Kim described. We wanted to know about her experience on this case from start to finish.
Before we play the audio, we just wanted to put in a disclaimer that some parts can be disturbing or graphic.
Well, the day that I was called in to see him, I had no idea what I was walking into at the time. When I went in to talk to him, I did not want anybody in with me. I just went in there to see him, and he was rather cordial, very nice, very soft-spoken, and I did not feel threatened in any way. But then, of course, I certainly wasn't his type. What he wanted out of everything, out of life, was companionship that he never had. But he always wanted to be in control. So that's what it all came down to, and that's what he was in search of. It wasn't that he wanted to necessarily harm anybody initially. It was that he just didn't want people to leave him.
The first thing we wanted to address was why he committed these murders and if they had anything to do with childhood trauma.
Well, that was the major questioned throughout the entire case, and which was the hardest part. And that's why, you know, everybody felt that he was a stronger candidate to be studied rather than to be put into a prison system. I mean, there really wasn't anything that stood out about him that we could say from being a youngster on would have given any idea to anyone that he was destined to be one of the world's biggest serial killers.
We then went on to ask her about his character overall.
The guy was a little strange overall, but I mean, I don't know, because I didn't know him outside of that, the jail, whether or not it was because that was his true personality, or, you know, whether it was because of circumstances. I can tell you this. He was very, very cordial. He'd be the only one who would notice when I had a new outfit on. Said, oh, you know, you look very nice today, Miss Bancher. You're thinking, you know, it looks like you got a new outfit. And he just would be great.
At this point, we noticed the way Jeffrey complimented Wendy was quite similar to Kim's observations of the man she worked with.
When we would talk about what happened to the individuals, he actually had a good memory of that. He would tell me about it, but he would get a very disassociative look about him. I mean, he actually kind of went back, almost like a flashback, into, you know, what had happened. I said, what was your ultimate goal? And other than wanting someone who was going to be a companion and stay with him, but under his control.
Wendy then went on to tell us what Jeffrey would do with some of his victims.
You know, his regular process as far as luring men in, you know, once he got them to come home to, you know, his place, what he would do is drug them and then make a decision as to how he was going to deal with them from there. You know, one of the most famous incidents is with Conorak Synthesimphone, who he was the second individual that he attempted to make into kind of a, you know, he did a crude lobotomy to keep him alive, to be kind of like a zombie. He wanted to have him, you know, with him and be able to do with what he wanted with him. But he needed to control his brain somehow. So when he drilled into his head, he put warm water in there and kept him alive literally for 72 hours. The first one that he attempted that with, he had put acid in after drilling into his head, and unfortunately that killed him immediately, which he should have known.
Finally, we heard about his death. It was incredibly interesting how he'd come to terms with what he had done before he was killed, because his relationship with God had made him feel as if he had been forgiven.
He said, I've made my peace, I've been baptized, I have been reading the Bible and talking with spiritual counselors here, and I'm ready to go. As a matter of fact, he gave me his Bible, and it was, you know, wonderful, but I'm just saying that he knew that it was something that might happen, but he wanted to be in general population, and at that time, literally, like I said, it was a tearful encounter, and I just said I wished he would change his mind because I didn't want to lose him yet, and I knew as soon as he went into general that it wouldn't take but a minute for somebody to kill him, and that's exactly what happened.
Although Wendy believes that the reason he killed was in order to prevent people from leaving, we feel there has to be more to that. It appears not much was uncovered from his childhood, so we feel that something must have happened, such as abuse. Most people with violent tendencies have early trauma, so it would be a very logical answer. Also, it was unsettling to hear that Dahmer came off as friendly and just like everyone else. That raises the question, how many people are like this but lead normal lives where they go unsuspected? That's not a question we can answer, but we can identify some serial crimes that reside in our small mountain valley. Belle and I decided to attend some hearings at the Glenwood Springs Courthouse. Unfortunately, recording devices are not permitted beyond the security checkpoint at the front door, so we will just have to tell you about our experience and what we observed.
As soon as we entered, it was very quiet. We were greeted by a young uniformed police officer who was very kind and helped us find our way around. The sentencing hearings we went to observe were located on the fourth floor. We decided to take the old echoey staircase. We felt nervous and slightly uncomfortable, like we didn't belong here. Once we reached the fourth floor, we entered a waiting area with black chairs, Christmas tree green carpet, fluorescent lighting, and pictures of the district judges hanging on the wall. We waited for about 10 minutes and decided to enter the courtroom. Courtroom C was a lot smaller than we expected. There were only about 3 rows of wooden benches for observers. The room had a green color scheme like the waiting room and was accompanied by light wood features. As we looked up, we saw many security cameras that captured every section of the room. Once we sat down in the front row, we waited for about 15 more minutes. Straight ahead of us, beyond the judges' stand and the large U.S. and Colorado flag, was an open door. We saw many police officers pass and at one point saw 3 handcuffed men in striped jumpsuits being escorted by a police officer in the front and the back. We were surprised. We had never seen anything like this in person. Finally, after a long wait, 4 handcuffed individuals were escorted into our courtroom, and that is when it all began.
One of the sentencings was of a middle-aged man, presumably in his early 50s. He was not one of those in custody. In fact, he sat fairly close to us on the wooden benches. He rose from the bench to enter the stand. He wore a green zip-up sweater with baggy jeans and had messy brown hair mixed with streaks of gray. The man had struggled with his mental health for years, and it had caused him to act in a violent manner on several different occasions. On this specific case, in the span of 2 days, he hit someone in the hand with a baseball bat in the Walmart parking lot, and then the next day proceeded to threaten to hit another individual with the same baseball bat in a Wendy's. The victim of the assault in the Walmart parking lot wanted to see him get the maximum sentence. However, he was only sentenced to 3 years on probation, which included 30 days in the county jail.
Another one of the sentencings was of a young man who couldn't have been more than 2 years older than us, so around the age of 19. He had dark black hair that was shaved close to his head. He walked up to the stand, slumped over, looking at the ground, with a large blue jacket hung over his body, blue jeans and sneakers. He had raped one girl at a party and attempted to sexually assault another woman in a parking lot. When he was at the stand, he spoke in a hushed and low tone when he pled guilty to all of his charges. Later on, during the other hearings, he appeared from behind a door in a long-sleeve gray shirt and handcuffs. The young man's sentencing was then pushed to December, where he would be sentenced anywhere from 6 months to 6 years in prison. Witnessing these hearings within our own valley made us realize something.
Sociopaths make up 3 to 5% of the world's population, which is not an overwhelmingly high percentage. A serial criminal cannot necessarily be labeled a sociopath. It is much more likely that they have certain sociopathic traits or have had a really tough upbringing. Serial criminals, whether they are sociopaths or not, are everywhere. You will not necessarily encounter many of these people in your life, but you never know if they are simply people who have a patterned behavior or if they are a sociopath who has the ability to manipulate you and use you to their advantage. That is why it is important to recognize the behaviors of sociopaths. The content we witness in television and other forms of media seems so distant from us oftentimes. Though much of it is fiction and is embellished, and the dramatization speeds up the process of the criminal justice system, it is still based on things we see in the real world. Many people remain oblivious to the negative events that occur in our world. But in order to move forward in society, we must acknowledge these events and learn how to recognize these people by noticing the early signs that sociopaths tend to show. At the end of this process, we found a podcast called My Favorite Murder that is about 2 women who are very similar to us in the sense that they are fascinated by crime. There was a scientific explanation behind the show's success. A study published in 2010 in the research journal Social, Psychological, and Personality Science cited in the New York Times found that, quote, women use tales of rape, murder, and serial killers as a way to process the dark persistence of misogynistic violence in society at large, unquote. We really related a lot to the hosts of My Favorite Murder, Georgia Hardstark and Karen Kilgariff, because they talked about crime very nonchalantly. They don't seem to find even gruesome crimes disturbing. They were saying that they were so desensitized to crime that people must think they are psychopaths. And we relate to this because we don't find the details of crime disturbing either.
Giselle doesn't really connect with the idea that women use crime stories to process misogyny. But for me, I think that tales of rape are interesting because I have a personal connection to that. I wasn't sure I wanted to talk about it on air at first. However, I feel like I use crime stories to process my own situation in relation to what that person was thinking. Also, I think that for people who relate to it, it doesn't necessarily give you peace of mind, but it assures you that other people have experienced something similar or exactly what you've gone through. At the very least, it's nice to know that there's other people out there who are struggling with the same questions or the same thoughts that you have. Even though I know that the episodes of Law & Order SVU and CSI are fiction, I still thoroughly enjoy watching them because of the process that the detectives go through and the courtroom scenes that you see the DAs taking part in. Even though many of these cases are made up, it still gives the viewer a look into what goes on during an investigation. Growing up and living in Carbondale, many of us are detached from the idea of criminal activity, since we live in such a small town. However, when we went down to the courthouse, we were opened up to other people's lives who are affected by crime, whether that's the police, lawyers, judges, the guilty parties, or the victims. Real crime affects people's lives in ways that they are often unable to escape from.
After a lot of reflection and comparison between the court cases that we saw and Jeffrey Dahmer's actions, we don't believe that Dahmer enjoyed inflicting the pain that he did on other people, because he came to a point in his life where he felt like he was out of control and wanted to get caught. And that's why he wasn't disposing of the bodies of his victims like he had done before. Because Dahmer was in some twisted sense looking for companionship, we don't believe that he was evil. We think that he didn't believe he could find another way to get what he needed emotionally, other than by killing victims, having sex with them after murdering them, and trying to keep some of them alive by any means necessary.
People who are evil want to commit the crimes that they commit. They don't feel remorse for the people who they have caused pain to physically and mentally. For example, serial rapists are intentionally trying to harm a person and inflict pain on them that is damaging physically and mentally for a long time. They may feel sorry for getting caught, but not for what they did because of their motives for committing their crime and how they made committing their crime okay in their minds. That is evil, wanting to intentionally harm a person because you know you can and because you want to. While Dahmer's actions were gruesome and unforgivable, he did it because he wasn't sure how to deal with his emotions in another way, not because he wanted to inflict pain on another person.
This is KDNK Carbondale, Community Access Radio, Glenwood Springs, Carbondale, the Roaring Fork Valley, and beyond. You are listening to the Andy Zinka Youth Empowerment Program, and my name is Beth Weisong, and I am here with two students from Colorado Rocky Mountain School, Belle and Giselle, who just gave us that podcast on the psychology of serial criminals, a very heavy topic, but thanks, ladies, for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for presenting that. Tell us what prompted you to choose that topic.
Well, originally, something we've bonded over as friends is that we're really interested in crime, like serial killers to be specific. And at least for me, like I've grown up watching horror movies and that's been a big source of like, oh, like why do people do this kind of thing? What are the psychological influences? And I think it's been kind of similar for Belle. I don't know if you want to talk about that, but
yeah. And then it's like we kind of talked about this in the podcast, but like initially we wanted to do it like in the differences between rural and urban crime. But then I went on my like college visits and I visited this one university that had a class on serial killers, and that like prompted me to be like, oh, that would be like a really cool podcast. And so we ended up changing it, which was actually kind of fun.
A little more focused, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. So what I've been asking each group, what was the most challenging part? What was that for you ladies?
Well, I think, as we said before, we decided to change our topic. We had a kind of a similar topic, but it was more of kind of comparing the crime that happens in our valley to crime that happens in urban settings, and that we were having some challenges with that. And we had all of our audio collected. We had all of these interviews, and we had interviewed people on the streets of Carbondale. And it just, I don't know, it was kind of hard for us to make a conclusion and have one definitive focus with that. And so I guess probably changing our topic was the most difficult because we were already so far in the process.
Yeah, and I think another thing that we had trouble with was the ambient noise because you can't record in a courtroom. And so trying to, like, convey that scene in any other way is a little bit challenging when you don't, when, like, people aren't looking at it or people can't necessarily hear what's going on. And so that was a little bit difficult, and, like, coming up with, like, really vivid and, like, good descriptions of what everything looked like and what, like, how we felt. So that was also kind of challenging, too.
Well, you certainly overcame that challenge because it was a great portion of your piece. What did you enjoy the most about, other than getting to work together and that you're passionate about this topic, what did you enjoy the most?
I'm sure this was a highlight for you, too, but talking to Wendy Patricus, who was on Dahmer's case, was really interesting because that's one of, like, the most famous, one of the most famous serial killers of all time. And that's just really cool to talk to someone who knew him so we could actually kind of examine a real life situation. So that was really, really cool, in my opinion. I think you found that interesting, too. But
yeah, I thought that was really cool, mainly because, like, I didn't know too much about who he was even to begin with. And so it was really interesting to, like, hear from someone who, like, worked with him and has, like, firsthand experience talking to him and being around him. And so I thought that was really interesting, too.
Yeah, pretty fascinating, right? Well, is there anything else that you want to add before we move on to our last podcast for the afternoon?
Yeah, so even though we didn't end up using some of these people's interviews, we just wanted to thank Tony Hershey, Alex Haynes, Ann Norden,
Rob Pierce,
and then Kim Reel and Wendy Patricus for taking the time to just interview with us. And
yeah, that was really great. Yeah. And then we'd also like to thank Eric Skeef, our teacher, because he helped a lot with the process, and he kept pushing us to make it better, even when we thought that it was done. He was like, no, you should do this, and it'll make it better. And ultimately, I think it came out really great. I think we're proud of it, and so we're thankful that he helped us so much.
Yeah, you should be very proud. It was a great, great piece, and thanks for bringing it to Katie and Kay and sharing it with all of our listeners.
Yeah,
congratulations. The semester's almost over, huh?
Yeah.
You just have finals this week?
Yep, finals starting tomorrow.
Well, good luck. You just finished this big project, so congratulations and thanks for sharing.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to Katie and Kay and the Andy Zanka Youth Empowerment Program. We have one more podcast from Morgana and Flannery about high school. I think their topic is what makes a good high school experience. So thanks for tuning in to Katie and Kay, and we will be back after this podcast.